First day of the Omer. If you have not counted last night, you should count now without a bracha. And because it's the 31st day of the Omer, we're going to have a discussion this morning about Lag BaOmer. That is upcoming. This coming Wednesday, we're going to count Lamed Gimel BaOmer, this coming Wednesday evening. So I want to talk about the history and the development of Lag BaOmer. And it's a fascinating topic. Most of the sources in the history part of this year come from the journal Yeshurun. There's a very interesting journal that comes out a couple of times, once a year, I think, twice a year. So there's a beautiful article that was written by Moshe Isaac Bloy. I know nothing about him, but he's some sort of historian who really looked into this. And I took many of the sources in history from him. I am not a historian at all. The premise of today's shiur, just by making things very clear, the premise of the entire shiur today is for those who keep the first half of Sfiras HaOmer, for those who have the practice to mourn over the first half of the Sfiras HaOmer. So now we're going to explain what Lag BaOmer is all about and how it developed. For those who have the practice to keep the second half of the Sfira, it's a totally different story. So let's begin like this. There's a very well-known, a very famous Gemara, as we'll see here, but we've all heard this Gemara before. The Gemara says in Yevamos Samach Beis Amud Beis, that's the first source on the sheet, Shnei Maser Elav Zugim Talmidim Hayilo Rebbe Kiva. This is the beginning of the story of Lag BaOmer. So it says that there were 12,000 pairs of students that learned in the yeshiva of Rebbe Kiva, Migivas Vad Antiparas. It's not really clear exactly where these two communities are. Simple understanding is that they're both on the northern border of Israel, and they were from east to west. So it means he had many students that spanned a very large area of Eretz Yisrael. And not only do we know that Rebbe Kiva taught these students, not only do we know that he was a Rosh Yeshiva, that he was a Mechanech par excellence, but what we also know about him from various stories in the Gemara is that he was such a dedicated, he was so devoted to his Talmidim. He was so invested in their success, in their future. The Gemara tells us that one time, one of the Talmidim of Rebbe Kiva got sick, and all the different friends of his came to visit in the home, and they were in and out. Everyone was visiting at a different time, and finally Rebbe Kiva himself comes, and he sees that the sheets are dirty, and he sees that the floor is not clean. He sees that they need to have a cleaning lady come to the house. And it turns out Rebbe Kiva himself gets down on his hands and knees and he cleans the floor and he changes the sheets. And all of a sudden the Talmud gets better and he says, Rebbe Hichi Yisani, you have now given me life again. And from there Rebbe Kiva learned that whenever a person is being Mevakar Chola, it's not just that you come and visit and you say hello or you say goodbye or you call on the phone. You have to look into the needs, into the interests of the person who is sick. You can't just walk in and out. You have to check. Is the room hygienic? Is everything clean? Is everything to the best of the possible circumstances that the person can be living with right now? But what I see from there is, let's not get caught up on the details of that story, what you see clearly from that story is that Rebbe Kiva was not just a Rebbe to his Talmidim. What you see is he was completely invested in the Talmidim that he taught, and he wanted so much for their well-being. The Gemara tells us in other places as well about the form in which Rebbe Kiva used to teach them. It tells us that Rebbe Kiva didn't only teach them Torah, but he taught them Midos and Derech Eretz. He was so invested in making sure that he had well-rounded Talmidim, which is surprising because now we continue the end of the story. That Vekula Mesa Beperek Echad. Here you have Rebbe Kiva teaching all of his students, and yet all of them perished, all of them died Beperek Echad. In one period in history, in one short period, a span of time, all of these 24,000 students perished, all of them died. Why, says the Gemara, Mipnei Shelo Nagu Kavod Zelazet. Very hard to understand, because the Talmidim weren't respectful of each other. First of all, is that a reason they should all die? And second of all, how can it be? We know Rabbi Kiva is the one in the Yerushalmi who teaches us, so probably every day, if I had to imagine, every day they're sitting in the Beis Medrash, Rabbi Kiva makes a clap on the bima, every day, probably once an hour, he says, don't forget, every hour. You think his Talmidim forgot about it? So this cannot be understood at face value. Whatever it might mean, I'm not exactly sure what it means. Hard to really understand. I've seen many interpretations as to, yeah, on their level, they did something. I don't know. I don't know what to make of all of that. Still, even on their level, how they lost their life, 24,000 of them. And after the first 10,000 of them died, nobody realizes maybe it's time to do tshuva, maybe we've done something wrong. Not sure exactly. I did see a beautiful interpretation, which to me is very relevant. I saw a beautiful interpretation from the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, where he writes a beautiful insight that perhaps what happened here was, it's not that they were fighting with one another, it's not that they were disrespectful with one another. He said what happened was like this. For anyone here who's familiar with Rav Soloveitchik and with what happened after he passed away, you'll understand and appreciate this insight of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He says, sometimes in history, we have a personality who is so multifaceted, who has so many talents. Take, for example, Rav Soloveitchik. So you have a person who's known as a great Talmud Chacham, a great Rosh Hashiva, a great philosopher. He's a great speaker, an unbelievable orator. He has so much about him. It's impossible for one Talmud, for one student, to take everything from the Rebbe. It's just not possible. You have somebody who's larger than life. Even if you sit by that Rebbe for a long time, you cannot take everything that that person has to offer. So over here, we have Rav Soloveitchik passes away, and you have a lot of students who are fighting about who's the real Mesorah of Rav Soloveitchik. Who's the real one who's carrying on the torch? Who's giving over the legacy the way it really was? So you have this one's printing Svarim, and that one's printing Svarim, and each one's saying that the other one is misrepresenting what the Rebbe was all about. My father always says, nobody's misrepresenting. We all happen to have taken one small aspect of the greater personality that he was. Nobody's giving a misrepresentation. He stood for so many different things. He was such a multifaceted personality. Therefore, we all have different viewpoints, different things that we picked up. If your personal hashkafa happens to be more into philosophy, so you picked up more of the philosophy side. If your intuition happens to be more into learning Torah, so then you picked up all of that from him. So everyone had a different thing. So that's what the Lubavitcher Rebbe suggested happened with Rabbi Kiva as well. Rabbi Kiva at this point was a very old man, and his students realized that they're learning with a giant of a person, and they were concerned what's going to be after Rabbi Kiva passes away. We're all going to have to figure out how to carry on the tradition, the authentic tradition of Rabbi Kiva to our Talmidim. And they were fighting with each other, L'shem Shemayim. They were fighting and saying, you didn't pick up the real authentic Rabbi Kiva. You were only there a couple of years. You didn't really understand what Rabbi Kiva was all about. And the other one said, no, we have the real tradition. And everyone was feeling L'shem Shemayim because they wanted to carry over the Mesorah the way it was supposed to be given over to the next generation. And therefore, because it got very serious, very heated, the Gemara tells us, Shalo Nagu Kavod Zelazeh. I think it's a very fascinating interpretation. Whether it's correct or not, I don't know. But it's a very fascinating thought to consider because we see it happening in our own generation. When you have people who are students of a great man, so very often they get into disagreements about what the true, what the authentic Mesorah is of that person, and perhaps they're all right. Perhaps they're all right. Perhaps they all have one little perspective of the greater persona that the person actually was. So that's a fascinating shot into this Gemara. Anyway, the Gemara says they all died b'perek echad, because they were lo nagu kavod zelazeh, v'haya ha'olam shamem, says the Gemara. The world was desolate, the world was empty, after these 24,000 students died, the world was empty. Ad sheba Rabbi Kiva eitzel Rabbi Asenu shebedarom, until Rabbi Kiva comes down to the south of Israel. Now here he is, Migivas means his Talmidim, he used to teach them all the way in the north. Everybody just got wiped out. Makes a trip all the way down to the south of Eretz Yisrael, and he finds a group of five students, Bishana Lehem. He reopens a new yeshiva the very next day after his Talmidim all passed away. He starts a new yeshiva with five new students, Bishana Lehem. And who were they? Rab Meir, Rab Yehuda, Rab Yossi, Rab Shimon, Rab Elazar ben Shamua. These were the five students that were chosen at that time to restart the yeshiva. V'heim heim heim midu Torah osasha. And they were the ones who bolstered, they were the ones who reignited the flame of Torah at that time, after everything had been decimated, after everything had been destroyed because of the 24,000 students died, they were the ones who restarted everything and got Torah going once again. Not only did they get Torah going once again, what they did do was, we do find, let's say in Mishnayos, very often you have a disagreement between one Tana and another Tana. Very often in the Gemara you have a disagreement, in the Medrash you have a disagreement. But what do? When you have a Mishnah and you don't know who the author of the Mishnah is, who do we assume wrote that Mishnah? Who is the opinion that's speaking in that Mishnah if the Mishnah doesn't tell us? So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Pei Vav, Stam Mishnah is Rav Meiri. Every Mishnah that doesn't have a name to it is Rav Meir. Now Rav Meir is one of the five Talmidim, which means all of Torah Shabbal Peh is from those five students. And not only that, the Gemara says Stam Medrash, Stam Sefri, Stam Sefra is Rav Yehuda. All of these five students of Rabbi Kiva that started the new yeshiva after the 24,000 passed away, not only did they carry on the torch of Torah Shabbal Peh, but they are the mainstay of Torah Shabbal Peh as we know it. All of Torah Shabbal Peh that we have comes from those five students of Rabbi Kiva when they started the new yeshiva, which is so fascinating. We've been learning Gemara, we've been learning Mishnayos, we've been learning so much for the last few thousand years, and it's all because those five students stood up and were willing to have the courage to start a new yeshiva. Anyway, the Gemara ends off and says, Tana, Kula Mesu, all of these 24,000 students died, mi Pesach v'ad Atzeres, which means, in a 7-week span, all of them died. Just consider for a minute what that means. 24,000 students passing away in a 7-week span. Can you imagine how many Levayas you're going to every single day? Imagine how many Levayas it is. And certainly one will see in a couple of minutes that it was shaved down. They didn't die from Pesach till Shavuos. They died from Pesach till Lag BaOmer, as we'll see in a few minutes. It means Rabbi Akiva was showing up to over 750 Levayas a day. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of grieving families. 750 Levayas every single day. That's what was happening. These are very, very important questions. I don't know. It's very hard to understand the Gemara, meaning what exactly went wrong. And as we'll see later, Rabbi Akiva understood what went wrong. You'll see in the Medrash that we'll quote later in the Shir, Rabbi Akiva certainly understood, because when he got these five students together to restart the yeshiva, he warned them and he said, don't make the same mistake that my last students made. And let's make sure that we have the rules straight. Let's make sure we know how to treat each other properly. So Rabbi Akiva understood what was happening. Why didn't he get involved? I don't exactly know. But based on the story that's recorded in the Gemara, as we see it, this is why we have the practice nowadays to have a period of bereavement in the days of Sfiras Omer. Because the Gemara says that this took place in between Pesach and Shavuos, and this was a catastrophic loss to the Jewish people. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Taf Tzadi Gimel, where we're told that the practice is in all communities that we have some sort of avelus, we have some sort of form of mourning at this period in history, because we know that this story took place with the catastrophic loss of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. Now, if we can digress for a few moments, I think it's important to make note of the fact. We mourn over the Churban Beis HaMikdash that happened 2,000 years ago, but the reason that we mourn is because we still feel the lacking of Beis HaMikdash. It's still not here. But why do we mourn over the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva? They should have mourned then, and maybe the next generation or the next, but why are we still mourning now? And what you see clearly is that obviously this loss of 24,000 students, 24,000 Talmidei Chachamim, is something that is germane, it's relevant to our generation as well. And the question is why? Why is that of any relevance? We've lost so many people over the generations, why is this of any significance and relevance 2,000 years later to talk about the fact that Rabbi Akiva's students perished in a period in history and now we're going to mourn over their loss? And I believe the answer is based on what we see in the Gemara here. If you look carefully in the story, we're told, after the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva pass away, Vahaya ha'olam shamem. The world was desolate, the world was empty, it was bereft of spirituality. And why is that? Why do you assume the world was empty? Don't we know there were great Talmidei Chacham living at the time? Rabbi Yossi was alive, we had Rabbi Tarfon was alive, many other contemporaries of Rabbi Akiva were alive. So what do you mean the world was empty? The world was not empty at all. There was plenty going on at the world. Yes, we lost 24,000 students, but we say in the Gemara that it was empty. And perhaps the reason is because each and every individual Talmud Chacham has so much uniqueness to offer to the generation. And they have so much that they were put on this world to accomplish. Their mission, their purpose is something that nobody else can replicate. And when you lose 24,000 of those one day, people who are going to bring about so much good into the world, and not only make a difference to their generation, but make a difference to so many future generations as well, this is something that can never be made up. This is something that's a loss, that's going to be a loss forever, and it's something that even makes a difference to our generation as well, because imagine, had our generation had all the Torah, all the inspiration, all the purpose, all the aspirations of those generations of Talmidei Chachamim who passed away, we would have been such a different people. We would have had so much more Torah to deal with. We would have had so much more that we could learn and we can study and we can really elevate ourselves from the teachings of those 24,000 students. Rabbi Soloveitchik was fond of saying over, my father writes it in one of the Svarim, that one of the most fundamental principles in all of the mitzvah observance that we have is the mitzvah of the halachta bedrachav, that we have an obligation to somehow emulate, to somehow embody all of the midos that we find himself as. We are supposed to do the same. And the question is, how exactly do we do that? What are the midos of Hashem? How do we really know the way He acts is the way we're supposed to act? What exactly does that mean? Rav Soloveitchik said that perhaps it means not only what the Gemara says, that we should be compassionate the same way that God has compassion. It doesn't only mean that, but it means a lot more than that. He suggested the following, that when we say Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad every day in Shema, what we mean by Hashem Echad is not that God is one. What we mean is that God is unique. God is different. We have no way of describing the existence of God because it's not like anything else that we have in our lives. It's an experience that we don't have in any other aspect of our lives. And therefore, when we say Hashem Echad, we mean not that God is one, but rather that God is unique. He's different than anything else we have ever experienced in our lifetime, in our existence. And therefore, Rav Soloveitchik said, we have an obligation the same way Hashem Echad, so too we have an obligation to be echad as well. We have an obligation and a responsibility to be unique, to show our uniqueness, to bring forth to the community what our contributions could be that nobody else can contribute to the Jewish story. Rav Soloveitchik writes how he grew up in a family, you'll read it on your own in number bays, but he writes how he grew up in a family where he met great Talmidei Chachamim all around his father's table, and they were always in and out of his house. And he said he was able to see how each one had their own gisha, how each one had their own unique contribution that they made and their own responsibility and their own relationship that they carried with God Himself. And none of them were going to be the same. And I believe when you talk about 20,000 Talmidim, it's the same perspective we're supposed to have. Each one had so much that they were going to offer uniquely, individually, and it's something that cannot be replicated because it was an opportunity that only they had to bring to this world that nobody else could have possibly brought in later generations. So this is something that we mourn not only over the loss from 2,000 years ago, but it's a loss that we mourn even today because it does have extreme relevance to the lives that we are living today as well. We are told, in fact, in Parshas Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Charana. We're told that Yaakov Avinu leaves Be'er Sheva and he goes to the city of Charan. Why does he leave Be'er Sheva? Because he's a fugitive. His brother wants to kill him. So he leaves and he has to run away and he goes to Charan. Yaakov Avinu is running away. Rashi says, why was it important that we're told Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva? We know that Yaakov is growing up in a home in Be'er Sheva. We know that Yitzchak and Rivka live there. So why is it necessary to tell us Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva and he travels somewhere else? We know, obviously, if he left, it means he left the home where he was living. So Rashi explains from the Medrash, look at number Gimel, that we learn from this passage in the Chumash, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, we learn from there that Yitzias Tzadik Osa Roshim. We learn from here that when a tzaddik chooses to leave a community, it makes a big difference. It has an impact. Kishat tzaddik ba'ir, when the tzaddik is dwelling in the city, hu hadara, he is the splendor, he is the pride of town. Pana hatzaddik manayir, but once the tzaddik chooses to leave for whatever reason, pana ziva, pana hadara. We have lost all the shine, we have lost all the influence that tzaddik could have brought to the generation and to the community. When Yaakov Avinu leaves, Be'er Sheva is not the same place. And the Medrash ends off, we're coming up to Shavuot, so this is relevant to us. We know that Rus and Naomi are living in Moab. Then they choose to take leave and go back to Eretz Yisrael. Says the Medrash, it's the very same thing. When Rus and Naomi choose to leave the city of Moab, the town, the community of Moab, all of a sudden, it's no longer the same Moab that it was. They don't have the influence of Rus and Naomi any longer. Rus and Naomi have now moved on to Eretz Yisrael, and it's never going to be the same without them. So when you think about it, why is it important that the Medrash tell us both of these scenarios, both Rus and Naomi leaving Moab and Yaakov Avinu leaving Be'er Sheva? Isn't it the same message? Isn't it the same point? Why do we need to learn it from two different periods, two different stories in history? And perhaps the reason why is because, of course, when you have a city like Moab, which is the decadent hub of society, and you have a community like that that loses a Rus and Naomi, obviously that's going to make a big difference. That's going to make an impression. We know that that's true. But when you have Yaakov Avinu leaves the home of Rivka and Yitzchak, you have great tzaddikim who are left in the city. You think it really makes a difference when Yaakov Avinu leaves? We're still left with great tzaddikim anyway. Yaakov left his parents behind. Be'er Sheva will be fine without him. And here the Medrash comes to tell us it's not the case. Not only when Rus and Naomi leave a community like Moab is the community affected, but even at Be'er Sheva, when you have Yaakov Avinu leaves, and he even leaves his parents behind to take care of the town, it's not going to be the same. Why? Because when you have a unique Talmud Chacham, a unique tzaddik living in a town, even if there are others who are there, it's never going to be the same, because what he or she could have brought to that town, to elevate that community, will never be brought by anybody else that might fill in their place. And that's what we learn from the loss of Yaakov Avinu, that's what we learn from the loss of Rus and Naomi, and this is certainly what we learn from the loss of 24,000 students that pass away in the generation of Rabbi Kiva. So now, let's get back to the story of Lag BaOmer. Let's try to understand what this Gemara says. If you read the Gemara carefully, the last three lines, three words of the Gemara are, they all died mi Pesach v'ad Atzeres, which means they died in a span of 7 weeks. Span of 7 weeks. So really, if you read the Gemara at face value, we should say, we should have a period of mourning from the time that Pesach begins until Shavuos, right? This is when all the students die. Now what's fascinating is, the Tur and other Rishonim write that they had a different girsa. They had a different text than the Gemara. The Tur writes in Siman Taf Tzadi Gimel that yes, even though the Gemara that you see, that we have here, says that they passed away in a 7 week span, we had a different girsa. Our text was that they only died until Lag BaOmer. So that's something which we don't find at all here, but this is something that the Tur writes was his tradition, and this is what other Rishonim write as well, that the dying did not happen throughout the duration of the 7 weeks. It only happened for the first 33 days of the Omer, first 32 days, and then on Lag BaOmer everything stopped. We still don't see anything that this is a reason to have Simcha. We don't find anything. All the Tur writes is that now that it's Lag BaOmer, and this was the day that they stopped passing away, that they stopped to perish, now we're allowed to once again take haircuts, now we're once again allowed to listen to music. But it doesn't say anything about special significance to the day of Lag BaOmer. It just says that from that day on, one is allowed to celebrate, one is allowed to rejoice. Then the Meiri, one of the later Rishonim, writes that not only do we assume that this was the day that they stopped dying, and not only do we assume that now the restrictions of mourning are lifted, but now, says the Meiri, we took it a step further. And the step further was that you are not allowed to fast on the day of Lag BaOmer, and we do not recite Tachanun on the day of Lag BaOmer. Why? Because we have some sort of celebration over the fact that they were no longer dying. Now you'll ask, of course they were no longer dying, there was nobody left. Right? 24,000 died, there's nobody left to die anymore. So that's a question that always bothered me, I'm not sure what the answer is. But the Meiri writes, not only do we assume that now we lift the restrictions of mourning on ourselves, but also he says it became a Yom Simcha. You look a little bit further, the Maharil, who was one of the, basically that's the commentator that the Rama bases much of his psak off of. So the Maharil says, yeah, we have the practice that we're not only do we not say Tachanun on this day, not only do we not fast on this day, not only do we lift the restrictions of Avelus, but this now turned into a Yom Simcha as well. This now turned into something special, something extraordinary on that day. Let's look at the Shulchan Aruch together in number Dalet. Says the Shulchan Aruch as follows. Noagim, we have the practice, as we said, Shelo Lisa Isha Ben Pesach Li'atzeres Ad Lag BaOmer. So we have the practice not to get married, not to listen to music, during this period until Lag BaOmer. Mipnei Sheba'oso Zman Mesu Talmidei Rabbi Akiva. Because in this period in history, the students of Rabbi Akiva perished. But to get engaged in the Kadesh, that would be permissible. Why is one allowed to get engaged in this period of time? Isn't that also like a wedding? So what do you think? So the Gemara says, because, hey, you always have to be worried. If I'm ready to get engaged, we've been dating, and now all of a sudden you're going to tell me, I'm ready to get engaged, first day Chol HaMoed Pesach, you're going to say, sorry, it's Sfira now, you have to wait till Lag BaOmer. Maybe in the next couple of weeks, somebody else is going to start going out with the girl, and then they're going to steal her. Shemi Kamenu Acher, the Gemara says, maybe somebody else is going to go out with that girl, and then I'm going to lose my chance to marry the one that I thought I should marry. So therefore, getting engaged, we never put off. Getting engaged is something you do right away. If you think it's the right one, and everything's worked out, don't delay it just because it's Sfira. So we do that. That's the minhag that we have nowadays as well. V'chei Noagim, and we have the practice as well, Shalola his stopper ad Lag BaOmer. We do not take haircuts until Lag BaOmer. Sha'omrim sha'az paskum ilamas. Now, this is something that obviously under extenuating circumstances one would be allowed to shave. This is just the practice that we have that we don't shave. But if something strange comes up, for whatever reason it might be, so then we assume that you would be allowed to shave, you would be allowed to take a haircut even during the first 33 days if it's extenuating circumstances. For example, I just had a story this week that there was somebody who was going away on a vacation with his wife, first time in 25 years. It was their 25th anniversary. And the wife was saying for a long time that she wants her husband to take her on a vacation. Finally, they went on vacation to Rome. And they went for a week, and she was all upset that her husband has a Sfira beard. And all the pictures are going to come out looking pretty nasty. And she was unhappy about the fact that her husband wasn't going to look as nice as she would have liked him to look on the 25th anniversary. So she asked her husband, maybe this year you can keep the second half of Sfira. This way you can shave in the beginning when we'll be on our trip, and then later on you'll keep the second half of Sfira. So he called Rav David Cohn, who's a great posek in Flatbush, and he asked him, can I switch this year because my wife is requesting of me, since we're going on the 25th anniversary, that I want to be able to keep the second half of Sfira. And Rav David Cohn said, no, you should keep the regular half of Sfira that you normally do. You shouldn't be flip-flopping every year, keeping a different minig. You should keep to what your general minig is. However, since your wife really wants it and you're going away on a vacation and this is something that's very meaningful to her, you should just shave. You should just shave to make your wife happy. It's not a problem. That's where Rav David Cohn gave up sock, and I think it's very correct. I think he's right that when you have extenuating circumstances, again, everyone has their own level of extenuating circumstances, but when you have extenuating circumstances, it's something that we assume we would allow. Let's say for business, a person feels that they're not well kept, they're not shaved, they're not something of that nature. Obviously, they would be allowed to do so. Seems not to be an issue here in the shul. Yeah.
If we're seeing here that Talmidim died until Lag BaOmer,
right?
And so the restriction is more, I want to assume, more important during the first half of Sphira, the first part of Sphira, and the second. Why is there a second question?
So what I started this year with, you missed the first part. What I started the first minute of this year, no, it's not a problem. When I started the first minute of this year, and it's good you mention it again, just to remind ourselves, that all of the discussion today about the development of Lag BaOmer is assuming that you're keeping the first half of the Sphira. Why is it that you might keep the second half of the Sphira? Where does that come from?
What's the relevance of second half of the Sphira?
So again, there are many who have a very different approach as to why it is that we have Avelis during Sphira. It's obviously not based at all on the Talmidei Rabbi Akiva. Otherwise, why would it be the second half of the Sphira? So that's a very important question. Not exactly relevant to the Shir right now. If you keep the second half of the Sphira, it means you have a very different understanding of why we're doing so. Perhaps the Zohar HaKadosh says because we need a 7-week period and when we get ready to be Mekabel the Torah. So we have to have some sort of mourning over ourselves, I guess, over the fact that we're not perfect human beings, that we have to perfect ourselves, we have a lot to work on, something of that nature, but it's not connected at all to the Talmidei Rabbi Akiva if you assume that you keep the second half of the Sphira.
So then someone's minhag should be based on what their understanding is of Sphira, not necessarily I want to keep the first half of the
Correct. It's really not right. It's not right to just bounce around every year and say, well, this year it works for me to keep the first half and next year it works for me. That's exactly what Reb David Cohen gave this person in the Psak last week, that if your family tradition is that you believe that the first half of Sphira is the right half of Sphira and that's the part that you're going to have the period of mourning, it's not right to switch it around. Your wife really wants you to shave and it really bothers her, okay, so then you should shave. That for you is extenuating circumstances, but it doesn't mean you should break all the laws of Sphira and all of a sudden switch over to keep the second half. Yeah. Right. Right. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that if somebody makes a wedding in a time that it's Sphira for you, so you're allowed to go because there's no reason that the Chasan and Kala should lose out. Obviously, it's a big loss if you're not going to be at the wedding. So there's no reason that the Chasan and Kala should lose out by you not attending the wedding because you have the minhag to keep Sphira. But Rav Moshe writes that it's not really right. The Rama even says that every community should choose on their own. I remember when I was in Eretz Yisrael, I don't remember which half they told everyone to keep. I think it was the second half. They said the minhag of the yeshiva was X. I don't remember which way it was. And they said, it doesn't matter what your family tradition is, everyone in the yeshiva has to keep the same minhag because it looks ridiculous. You're going to have half the people listening to music, half the people are not listening to music. Half the people are shaving, half the people aren't. It looks very silly. It doesn't make sense. The Rama says, as a community, we should decide together which half of the sphere we're going to keep. Now, nowadays that our communities have become so fragmented and so big, it's not the same as the Rama who lived in Krakow with 25 people in a shul. For anyone who's ever been to Krakow, the Rama's shul was tiny. So, of course, it's easy for him to say, yeah, we should all keep to one practice because your shul only fit 20 people. So, of course, you should follow the same practice. Now that we have such large communities and so many minyanim and so many shuls, it's not as relevant, it's not as easy, and everyone should follow the tradition that they have. Yeah. It's true, you're correct. People are getting married until Rosh Chodesh. People are getting married after Lag BaOmer. So for most of us, the Sphira only takes place between Rosh Chodesh and Lag BaOmer. It's very unfortunate. We shouldn't take this lightly. It's not a joke. It's something that should be taken with a certain degree of seriousness. Anyway, so let's continue over here. Now the Shulchan Aruch says, "Ve'ein lehistaper ad yom lamed dalet BaOmer." Anyone have a problem with that? "Ein lehistaper." Get back into the Shulchan Aruch. "Ein lehistaper." You should not take a haircut ad yom Lamed Dalet BaOmer. Why not 33? What's going on? Where does he get Lamed Dalet from? So apparently there was a difference in tradition here as well. Shulchan Aruch said, no, on Lag BaOmer they died also. They only stopped dying after Lag BaOmer. So the Shulchan Aruch and the Svarim followed the practice that only on the 34th day of the Omer are they allowed to celebrate. We, says the Rama, look at here the next line, Haggah. The Rama has a commentary. He says, hey, what are you talking about? B'medinas Elu Enogim Kain. We don't have the tradition that you had, Shulchan Aruch. You're saying only until the 34th day, only once the 34th day comes into existence are we allowed to start celebrating and lifting the restrictions of Avelis. Not true. Ela mistaprim biyom lamed gimel atzmo. We have the practice to start already having celebrations on Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day. Means we believe they only died up until the 33rd. Once the 33rd day came, that was the day to start rejoicing. And now the Rama adds this idea from the Maharil. Umar bin bo k'tzas simcha. Says the Rama, we're supposed to have some sort of celebration. Ve'ein omer bo tachanun. Now, it's a very difficult issue to explain why it is that communities make bonfires the night of Lag BaOmer with music. When I grew up, I followed what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that We assume that you're not supposed to listen to music till the next day, till the 33rd during the day. And we generally, for those who take haircuts, we don't take haircuts until Ashkenazim, till the daytime. We don't do it at night. So how come all of a sudden we don't take haircuts, we don't listen to music until the daytime? And all of a sudden there are communities who are doing bonfires at night with music. This is something that's very difficult to justify. It's a very hard thing to explain. And I remember when I was in the White Shul, they used to have a bonfire every year. When I was there, they had a bonfire every year. I gave a shiur the first year that I was there. I don't understand how I'm allowed to go. And the reason why it's very problematic is because, let's say, take for example by Avelis. So you have, God forbid, somebody sitting Shiva. So they have 7 days of Shiva. We all know that once the seventh morning comes, Miktsas Hayom Kukula, which means a partial acceptance of the seventh day of Shiva is already considered like you've done the whole day. Correct? So we all know the Avel sits Shiva in the morning, and then after an hour or two, they get up and that's it. That's the end of the Shiva. They don't have to finish it off because we have this concept of Miktsas Hayom Kukula. Part of the day is already considered as if you've done the entire day. Now there's a discussion in the Rishonim what exactly that means. Yes, we have a concept that Miktsas Hayom Kukula, but the Ramban says that we can already say once you've done a little bit at night, also you can knock off the rest of the day. So imagine you have a woman sitting Shiva on the seventh day of the Shiva period, and she sits down for an hour after it gets dark outside on the seventh night, and then she says, forget it, I'm done. She goes and takes haircuts, she goes and gets, not haircuts, she's in the middle of Shloshim, but she goes and takes a shower, does all the things that you're not allowed to do during Shiva, and she moves on. She says, why should I sit tomorrow morning? Miktsas Hayom Kukula. You've ever seen anybody do that? No. Why? Because we don't paskin like the Ramban. We paskin like the other Rishonim, that the only time you can use the principle of Miktsas Hayom Kukula, that part of the day is considered like the entire day, is once you had part of the daylight hours of the day, then you could say it's as if the whole day counted already. But just to use part of the nighttime hours and say it's as if I've used up the whole day, that's not acceptable. We don't hold like the Ramban. We assume Miktsas Hayom Kukula means you have to do a partial usage of the daytime hours in order to consider it as if the whole day has been kept as the day of Avelis. Now the same should be over here. The same should be over here. That Lag BaOmer, we say Miktsas Hayom Kukula. Part of the day is already considered like the whole day. So all you have to do is wait till the morning of Lag BaOmer and that's good enough. We don't say, like by Shiva, we don't say that by night it's already good enough. As long as you keep part of the night, that's good enough. That's not true. We don't say as long as you don't listen to music for 10 minutes at night, then already the rest of the day is considered as if you kept Lag BaOmer. It's not true. So if we don't assume like that by Shiva, then why do we assume like that all of a sudden when it comes to Lag BaOmer? Am I making any sense? All of us know the halacha by Shiva, and that's what the Shulchan Aruch says clearly. We don't hold like the Ramban. So how come all of a sudden when it comes to Lag BaOmer, there are many Hasidic communities that are all of a sudden holding like the Ramban? This is something that's very difficult to understand. Now, it's good to know when it does come to Shiva, take for example, we all know that a husband and wife are not allowed to be together during Shiva. That's one of the restrictions of Shiva. However, let's say you have a scenario, it happens every so often, let's say you have a scenario where the husband is going to go on a business trip early in the morning, the seventh day of the Shiva, he's going to go out of town for 2 weeks, and now the wife is in the middle of Shiva, so the seventh night of Shiva, she wants to be with her husband before he goes on a trip for 2 weeks. So we would be mekel, the Pischei Tshuva says, in a case like that, where it's extenuating circumstances, we have a right to rely on the opinion of the Ramban, and say, Miktsas Hayom Kukula applies already at night, because that's an extenuating circumstances. Or, for example, my father had a case where there was a woman sitting Shiva, an 80-year-old woman, amazing story, an 80-year-old woman was sitting Shiva, and it's not amazing to see she was sitting Shiva, the story is amazing. She was an 80-year-old woman sitting Shiva, and the Shiva was going to be over on Erev Pesach. That was the last day of Shiva. Not that Pesach was going to stop it, but Erev Pesach was the last day of the Shiva. So she was going to sit for an hour in the morning Erev Pesach, and then that was going to be it. But she said she's flying out of town to go to a hotel program. So she wanted to know, can she get the manicure on the night of the seventh night of Shiva? Even though a person who's sitting Shiva shouldn't really be doing that, but she felt, I want to look nice for the program. Maybe I'll get another shidduch at 80, who knows? So she was concerned that how can I go to the program without having my nails done? So my father said, look, you have to be honest with yourself. If to you this is something that's extenuating circumstances, like the husband's going out of town for 2 weeks, if that to you is the same as having your nails done or having your hair done or whatever it is, so then yes, we would rely on the Ramban and say you're allowed to go and do that on the seventh night of Shiva. However, if to you this is just something, oh, you want to look nice, but it's really not as important to you, it's just something that you feel you're looking for a heter, you're looking for a kula, so then obviously we would not allow such a thing. Okay, so now, so far so good. So now what we're up to is, We're up to the 1500s. The Ramah is living in the 1500s. He passes away in 1572. And as far as the Ramah is concerned, we find no connection at all between Lag BaOmer and Reb Shimon Yochai. Right? So far we haven't seen anything that connects to Reb Shimon Yochai, correct? All we have is the story that the Gemara tells us, 24,000 students pass away, they stop dying, Lag BaOmer, that's the way the Torah understands it, then it develops a little further, we don't say Tachanun, then it develops further, we have a Yom Simcha. The Ramah tells us this is a very joyous day, the Talmidim stop dying. We have nothing so far about Reb Shimon Yochai and Meiron. Now all of a sudden the story starts to get a little more interesting. Because now we have the Arizal comes on the scene around the same time as the Ramah. He's born in 1534 and he passes away in 1572. Anyone awake? How old was he when he passed away? Think about it. What?
38.
The Arizal, who goes down in history as the Ari HaKadosh. Everybody's heard of the Arizal, passed away at 38 years old. It's amazing. What a contribution he made to the world in only 38 years. So here you have the Arizal, who all of a sudden brings this new idea into fruition, that there's some sort of connection between Lag BaOmer and Reb Shimon Yochai. Now what's that all about? The Magen Avraham quotes this in the 1600s. The Magen Avraham says, yes, I have the tradition from the Arizal. He writes that we have some sort of connection between Lag BaOmer and Meiron and Reb Shimon Yochai. Let's read the story as follows. So the Arizal passes away at 38 years old. He doesn't have time to write so much because he's only 38 when he dies. So his students, Reb Chaim Vital was the foremost Talmud of the Arizal. Reb Chaim Vital and his son were two of the people that really wrote a lot of the things that we know from the Arizal. It's really from the students of the Arizal. We don't have so much from him himself. So here we have an account of what took place on Lag BaOmer and where this generated from. So let's read. The son of Reb Chaim Vital, who was also himself a student of the Arizal, writes the following story about the practice of going to Meiron. So let's look. Number hey. In the Sefer Shaar HaKavanos, the son of Reb Chaim Vital writes as follows: Inyan haminig shenagu Yisrael aleches biyom lamed gimel ba'omer al kivri Reb Shimon Yochai v'Reb Elezer b'no. So this is the first that we hear about going to Reb Shimon Yochai on Lag BaOmer. So far, we don't know anything about it. 1500s, this comes into being. Asher kvurim bi'ir meirom kanoda ba'ochlim v'shosim v'smeichem sham. And we have big parties and we eat and we drink and it's very exciting. Ani reisi lemori. I saw my Rebbe. Who is the Rebbe? Arizal. So the Reb Chaim Vital and his son are writing that they saw the Arizal. Shahalach l'sham pam achas biyom lamed gimel ba'omer. One day the Arizal is learning in yeshiva, makes a clap on the beam. He says, hey, it's Lag BaOmer today. Let's go up to Meiron. Everybody's looking at him. Why would we go to Meiron today? Nobody has ever heard of this. Arizal says, what do you mean? It's the Reb Shimon Yochai. So what, Reb Shimon Yochai? Yeah, we know. It's a kever of a tzaddik, but what does that have to do with Lag BaOmer? So he says, we're watching as the Arizal descends on Meiron. And he brings along his whole family. And he stays there for 3 days, one of them being Lag BaOmer. And he goes on and on, and then he has the following. He asks another one of his friends, do you remember what I remember? That the Arizal went to Meiron on Lag BaOmer to be there, the Kever of Shimon Yochai. Do you have this tradition? He says, Rabbi Yonah and Shagish Heidli. Obviously, this was another one of the students of the Arizal. He told me, Shabashana Harishana, hey, you were a little kid. You weren't in the yeshiva when I was there, but before you came to the yeshiva of the Arizal, I was there and I saw that he also went the year before you came. B'shana harishona, kodem sha'alachti ani etzla lumudim mori. Before I, the son of Reb Chaim Vital, came to the yeshiva of the Arizal, he was there earlier than me, this Avram Yonasan Shagish, I don't know who he is. He says, holach has b'na ha'katan l'sham. He brought his young children there. Imkal anshe beso. He brought up the whole family. Visham Gilcho as Rosh, they had an upshare in there. Kemina Gayadua, everybody knows that we do this on Lag BaOmer, which at this point nobody knew, but this is what he's saying. Va'aso Sham Yomishta Vesimcha, we made a big party by the grave of Reb Shimon Yochai. Now the story gets a little wild. Listen to this. Gamhei de Rabbi Avram Halevi. So now they have an account from a third student, Rabbi Avram Halevi. So far we have Reb Chaim Vital's son tells us he was there with the Arizal in Meiron. We have this Yonasan Shagish says, yeah, the year before then, I also went up to Meiron and I did an upsharing for my son. And now we have a third student also says, Kibishana on his keres, and that year that you're mentioning, Halach Gam Husham, Rabbeinu Avram also went up that year. Vahyanoi Glomer Bechol Yom Bebirchas Tishkon. Any Svardim in the room? Svardim. So, we Ashkenazim have the practice, every day in Shemona Esrei you say, V'li Yerushalayim Ircha. That's the Nusach that we know. The Sfardim have the practice to say Tishkon B'toch Yerushalayim. Instead of V'li Yerushalayim Ircha, they say Tishkon B'toch Yerushalayim, which means, it's sort of asking, not only for the Yerushalayim Ircha, they're asking that Hashem should rest His Shechina in Yerushalayim. So the Nusach is a little different. So here you have the Talmud of the Arizal, who obviously daven Nusach Ari, it's closer to the Svarim than the Ashkenazic version. So he says, every day in Birchas Tishkon, which is the bracha of V'li Yerushalayim Ircha and Shmona Esrei, so this Talmud, Rabbeinu Avram, used to beat himself up every day over the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Every day he felt the loss of the Beis HaMikdash, and he felt every day was like Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, but you know what? Every day is like Tisha B'Av. And because he had such a strong connection and feeling for the Churban Beis HaMikdash, every day in the Bracha V'li Yerushalayim Ircha, he used to add a paragraph. Which paragraph? Nachem. We insert a paragraph only on Tisha B'Av of Nachem, which is a special tefillah that Hashem should come back to Yerushalayim. He, this Rabbeinu Avram, whether he's right or he's wrong, whatever it was, he every day felt so connected to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, so every day of his life he made sure to say that paragraph, that insertion that we all say on Tisha B'Av. So listen what happens. So here he is on Lag BaOmer in Meiron. V'hayah nohig lomar b'chol yom b'birchas Tishkon, which as we know is B'li Yerushalayim Ircha in Ashkenaz, he used to fit in Nachem Hashem Elokeinu Saveh Litzion. He used to stick in that insertion every day in his Shemona Esrei. Gambi Yosi Sham, when I was in Meiron on Lag BaOmer, I also said what I normally say every day in my Shemona Esrei, I inserted the paragraph of Nachem. V'achar Shagamar HaAmida, but after I finished my quiet Shemona Esrei, Amarli Mori, all of a sudden I get the dirty look from the Arizal. And he's nervous. So he says, did you see what I saw? The Arizal turns to his Talmud and he says, did you just see what I saw? He says, no. He says, I saw ki ra'a b'hakitz esrb shimen yochai olav ha-shalom. The Arizal turns to his student and he says, I saw Reb Shimon Yochai just now, omed al kevaro, he stood up out of his grave, va'amar lo, and he says, Reb Shimon Yochai points with his finger at the student and he says, emor el ha'ish hazeh, tell this Avram, your student, who's sitting here saying Nachem, Avram ha'levi, lama hu omer Nachem b'yom simchaseinu. This is a day of rejoicing. Reb Shimon Yochai stands up on his grave and says to the Arizal, you should give Musar to his student, why is he saying the insert of Nachem on a day which is Yom Simchasenu? Wild story. V'hine, and Reb Shimon Yochai ends off and he says, V'hine lachein hu yiyah b'nachama b'karov. Yeah, he's saying Nachem on a day when he's not supposed to? You know what's going to happen? He's going to need a Nachama because something really bad is going to happen to him. And then the story goes, V'leyotza chodesh yamim at shemes lo ben echad v'kibel alav tanchumin. So this is a wild part of the story. I don't know what to do with it. But this is basically the story that's quoted in the Arizal. I'm sorry, in Reb Chaim Vital from that time that they went with the Arizal. That Reb Shimon Yochai stood up on his grave and said, this is Yom Simchaseinu, what are you doing? What are you so upset about the Churban? This is not the time for it. And this is the first time that we find that there was some sort of connection between Reb Shimon Yochai and Lag BaOmer, which is very fascinating. It's very fascinating that up until the 1500s, we know nothing about the fact that Reb Shimon Yochai is connected at all. And we still don't really understand. Reb Shimon Yochai says, this is Yom Simchaseinu. Why is it Yom Simchaseinu? Why are you so excited today? We know that Lag BaOmer goes down in history as Hilula de Reb Shimon Yochai. What does that mean? It means it's the party of Reb Shimon Yochai. Why is it the party of Reb Shimon Yochai? Why is it so exciting? We still don't know that. So now we go a little bit further and the story continues to develop. Now we have, in the 1600s, the end of the 1600s, a great gadol by the name of Rav Yonasan Eibishitz. Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, a lot of controversy came up in his days when he was fighting together with Rav Yaakov Emden. My father always likes to point out it was a joke of a fight. Rav Yonasan Eibishitz is the undisputed gadol hador living in Altoona in Poland. He was the undisputed gadol hador. And Rav Yaakov Emden is some clown, the son of the Chacham Tzvi. So again, we take him seriously, but he was a nobody compared to Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, and he happened to own a printing press, so he was in the advantage, so to speak. He was printing Pashkevilim, he was printing attacks against Rav Yonasan Eibishitz. Why was he printing against him? Because he believed that Rav Yonasan Eibishitz was one of the Sabbatheans. He was one of the people involved in Shabtai Tzvi, which is just amazing to think about the fact that this could have happened in the generation. Such a little nothing was starting up with the Gadol Hador on no ground at all. Very unfounded. So this is a major black period in our history of that fighting that took place between Rabbi Yonasan Eibishitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Be it as it may, Rabbi Yonasan Eibishitz writes in his Sefer Yaros Devash that not only do we know from the Arizal that Lag BaOmer is Yom Simchas Rav Shimon Yochai, but he takes it a step further. Look at number Vav. Says Rav Yonah Sanaibishitz, Yom Lag BaOmer Hu Yom Hilula de Rav Shimon Ben Yochai. Why is this a day of celebration of Rav Shimon Yochai specifically? Why? Because Ki Meisas, because this is the day that Rav Shimon Yochai died. This is his yahrzeit. So therefore, why is that a day to celebrate? So he writes, imagine the party that they had in Shamayim when Rav Shimon Yochai is reunited with his creator. Probably all the malachim come out to greet him. Everybody's so excited. Look who's here, a special guest, Rav Shimon Yochai. This is known as Hilula de Rav Shimon Yochai because this is the day that he passes away. It's like Hanara ba el Amelech. It's like we say in the Megillah when the woman comes to her husband, comes to the king. That was the same reuniting that took place between Rav Shimon Yochai and God himself. And says Rav Yonah Sanaibishitz, because this is the day that Rav Shimon Yochai passed away, because this is his yahrzeit, anyone who takes the religion seriously should be lasum talibo yamahu lasha b'tshuva. We should spend this as a day doing tshuva. Kizchus Rav Shimon Yochai misayas lehabal atahir. This is a special day when we have some sort of effect of Rav Shimon Yochai, so it will help us to do tshuva. That's the way he explains Lag BaOmer. Doesn't mean you should be going to carnivals on Lag BaOmer. That's not what we're supposed to be doing, says Rav Yonah Sanaibishitz. This is a day to take the religion seriously. Because this is a day when the effect of Rav Shimon Yochai is back in the world in some way. So this is the first that we hear. 1600 years after Rav Shimon Yochai passed away, nobody has ever claimed that this was actually the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai. This is the first time that we hear it. In the 1600s. Where did that piece of history come from? We'll see in a minute, not clear. And the Balatanya goes along with it, and others in that period write as well. Yeah, this is the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai, and therefore, it's the Yom Simchas of Shimon Yochai, because this is the day that he passed away. Now the Kedushas Levi, one of the Chassidus Sfarim, writes, that not only do we assume this was the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai, well, once you assume it was the yahrzeit, we assume it was also the birthday of Rav Shimon Yochai. So this keeps on developing. It starts over the Gemara that tells us in Yavamas no connection to Rav Shimon Yochai at all. Then we knock it down from being a 7-week period of mourning to only being a 33-day period of mourning. Then it gets developed a little bit further, and somehow we say that it's not only a day that we don't fast and we don't say Tachlim, but it's a day that we have Simcha, says the Ma'aril, as quoted in the Ramah. Then it moves a little further. All of a sudden the Arizal says, no, it's Yom Simcha, Rav Shimon Yochai, we should be going to Meiron. Not only that, all of a sudden develops a little further in the 1600s by Rabbi Yonah Sanaibishitz, who says, not only is it Simchas Rav Shimon Yochai, it happens to be the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai. And now it goes even further. Not only is it the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai, but it's the birthday of Rav Shimon Yochai also. To me, this is a fascinating development, and the question is where all this comes from. I know nothing about history, but what I did do the research on, they call this into major question, because the first source that we have of this aspect of the story, that the yahrzeit of Rav Shimon Yochai falls out on Lag BaOmer, the first source for that is in a Sefer Chemdas Hayamim. And that's where all the Gedolim got the source that Rav Shimon Yochai passed away on Lag BaOmer. Chemdas Hayamim was a Sefer that everybody learned, but it was a Sefer that was called into major question. Maybe he was one of the Talmidim of Shabtai Tzvi. So if the whole tradition perhaps stems from a Talmud of Shabtai Tzvi who may not have known the Mesorah as we know it, that calls into question everything that we really highlight about Rav Shimon Yochai on this day. Is it really true that Rav Shimon Yochai passed away on Lag BaOmer or not? If everything is dating back to the source of the Chemdas Hayamim who lived in the times of Shabtai Tzvi and was possibly a big follower of his, maybe we shouldn't be following anything that he says. So that to me is a very difficult part of the whole story. But be it as it may, whether you accept the historical evidence, whether you accept the historical facts that are being brought in, can't say facts because they're not such facts, whether you accept the historical assumption that Rav Shimon Yochai passed away on Lag BaOmer, there are many others who had objection to Lag BaOmer becoming what it became. Let's look at the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer lives in the mid-1700s, early 1800s, one of the greatest poskim that we have had in the last 200 years. Says the Chasam Sofer as follows. Likvoa moed shelo nasa bones. He says, for us to reinstitute, not to reinstitute, to make up a whole new holiday on a day where nothing happened. Nothing happened. It's not like Hanukkah where there was a miracle. It's not like Purim where there was a miracle. We don't know anything about any miracle that took place on this day. You're going to say, yeah, on this day you have to make a madura, you have to go to Lagba, you have to go to Meron, and you have to do it this way and not that way. Everybody has to take the bus up to Meron. I don't know if we're allowed to institute a new holiday for no good reason. Isn't that a violation of Baal Tosef, says the Chasam Sofer? Even Yom HaTzmaut itself was a major discussion. Are we allowed to institute a new day on the Hebrew calendar? Whether you believe in it, you don't believe in it, but there has to be a justification for something. A great miracle happened on Yom HaTzmaut. A great miracle happened on Yom Yerushalayim. Maybe there's what to talk about, but says the Chasam Sofer, to come ahead and make up a new holiday when nothing happened? Just because of the Hilula de Reb Shimon Yochai? And not only that, we have Reb Yosef Shaul Natanson, one of the greatest Gedolim in Poland in the 1800s, writes in his Shalos Atshuva Shalom Eishev, number Ches, Tamati, I am bewildered, I cannot understand this, Asha Smechem Behilula de Reb Shimon Yochai. Even if you agree that this is historically the Yahrzeit of Reb Shimon Yochai, and even if somehow you're going to get by the question of the Chasam Sofer, how are we allowed to make a new celebration, he says, fundamentally, why are we celebrating on a day that a tzaddik passed away? This is a day that we should be fasting. On the day that Reb Shimon Yochai passed away, that we lost so much with his passing, this is a day that we should be mourning, we should be fasting. And we know that we fast on the yahrzeit of a tzaddik. What's the most primary example? Moshe Rabbeinu, Zayin Adar. All over the world, Chever Kadisha, they fast on Zayin Adar. Why? Because it's the yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. And he says, I don't understand why all of a sudden this turned into a celebration. This should be the biggest day of mourning of the year. The Reb Shimon Yochai passes away. So we have a lot of discussion about how exactly Lag BaOmer developed, whether it's justified that it's true that Reb Shimon Yochai actually passed away on this day, and whether or not, even if you assume that that's correct, whether or not, number one, we're right to make some sort of major day of celebration out of this when really nothing actually happened, and number two, why are we celebrating on a day when a tzaddik passed away? Yes, it's called Hilula de Reb Shimon Yochai. It's called the exciting day of Reb Shimon Yochai because he went up to Shemayim. He was happy, but the world was left empty without him. So this is a very, very big question as to what exactly the story is with Lag BaOmer. But I believe whatever you want to believe or not believe about the story of Lag BaOmer, and whatever you want to observe, it's all wonderful. But I think there's a very important message that we can all take out of the story of Rabbi Kiva. It's undeniable. It's undeniable that the first 33 days of the Omer are kept a mourning period in commemoration of the Talmidei Rabbi Kiva who passed away. And when you think about Rabbi Kiva's life, Rabbi Kiva was a person who only began to learn Torah at 40 years old. We all know that story. Rabbi Kiva only started to learn Torah at 40. It wasn't only that he started to learn Torah at 40, but this was his entire way of life, that he always felt it's never too late. Rabbi Kiva was always a person who gave everything to give it another chance. He gave all that he had to always give life another chance and to always give the Jewish destiny another chance at having a greater future. Think about Rabbi Kiva for a minute. At the time that Rabbi Kiva was 40 years old, he starts to learn Torah. Then the Gemara says he studied Torah for 40 years. So he only started teaching at 80. And he passes away at 120. So he only has 40 years to teach. He teaches 24,000 students. It probably took him at least 20 years to do that. So he's probably 103, something like that, a little over 100, at the time that 24,000 of his students die. And this is a person who's working his whole life. It's not just this was his project. This was everything in his life. This is all he was living for. This is everything he had. This was everything he was working toward. And everything's gone. And think about the fact that the Bar Kochva rebellion was going on at the time. And there were those who were claiming to be Melech HaMashiach. And Rabbi Kiva was at the forefront fighting against them. Imagine what they were saying on the news reports at the time when 24,000 students of the primary antagonist against all the Melech HaMashiach people just lost everything that he's worked on in his entire life. Imagine what they said about him. Yeah, he's been fighting against us. Look, who's right now? So you have 103 years old Rabbi Kiva, who loses everything he had. He's probably being scorned and made fun of to no end. And yet, what is his reaction? What's his response? I'm going to go down to the south. I'm going to find the five Talmidim. And we're going to start over. So we made a mistake. And if you read the Medrash, we don't have time to read it, but in number 10, you read the Medrash, Rabbi Akiva says, we all make mistakes. And sometimes it's a catastrophic mistake. And sometimes it causes for our entire life's work to be destroyed. But yet, our response can never just be, forget it, I'm giving up. That's not the life of Rabbi Akiva. And just because I'm 40 years old and I don't know how to read Hebrew, doesn't mean I'm not going to become the greatest Tana that ever lived. And just because I lose everything I have at over 100 years old, and everything I've worked on in my life has now fallen into oblivion, does not mean that my life is over. And because Rabbi Akiva had the courage to start over and teach those five Talmidim, as we said, the entirety of Torah Shebaal Peh was saved. Everything that we have, all the Mishnayos, all the Gemara, all the Midrashim, are from those five students. It's an amazing thing to consider. Everything happened because Rabbi Akiva was willing to give life yet another chance. Let's look, Rav Soloveitchik, as quoted in the book Halachic Positions of Rav Soloveitchik. This is a book written by Reuven Ziegler. He writes something that my father writes over as well in Hebrew, but I thought people would prefer it in English. However, what is mandated or required and required from every Jew is not to despair or give up hope. According to Rav Soloveitchik, this positive attitude is what the Torah is teaching us in the very beginning of Sefer Bereishis. What's the story in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis? When Hashem created the world, the Medrash states that Hashem did not create a perfect world the very first time. Rather, He created many worlds that at first did not meet His expectations. The Medrash says He was Borei Olamo Samachrivan. In order to get the world perfectly straight, He had to create worlds, destroy them, create it, destroy them. He kept doing it over and over again, many, many times, until finally He got it right. And He subsequently destroyed them until He finally created our present world, over which He was pleased and expressed His satisfaction, as stated in the pasuk, "Vayara lekimas kala sharasa, v'hinei tov miot." Look at the next paragraph. The Rav asked, "How is it possible to understand that Hashem had to try several attempts until He achieved the desired perfection? When human beings attempt something new or experiment with something unknown, they proceed with trial and error. That's what we do. I want to know who I should marry. I don't know. Trial and error. I'm going to go out with this one. I'll go out with that one until I get it right. I want to try to create a new invention. I'm going to trial and error until I get it right." Of course that makes sense for us. This is incomprehensible to say that God Himself couldn't get it right. All He has to do is command, "I want a perfect world," and so it would be. So what does this mean? He was Borei Olam HaSamachriven. He couldn't get it right? Explainer of Soloveitchik, this Medrash, however, is really teaching us a lesson in life. The Medrash is forewarning us, as individuals, that we will not always succeed in our endeavors on the first try. God wanted that to be taught from the outset of the creation of the world. We may encounter many trials and tribulations, disappointments, heartaches, and failures, but we have no right to give up or despair. That is not permissible. Our challenge, based on Medrash, is to keep on trying and believing until, with the help of Hashem, we will succeed. That is why in the beginning of the creation of the world, we are told Hashem was Borei Olam HaSamachrivan, because He wanted to teach all of us that we never have the right to give up hope. It's just not a possibility. It's not something we're allowed to do. Rabbi Sachs writes in one of his books, The Dignity of Difference, "One of the most important distinctions I have learned in the course of reflection on Jewish history is the difference between optimism and hope." Now, I always thought those two were the same, but they're not. Optimism is the belief that things will get better. Hope is the belief that together we can make things better, which means optimism is a passive virtue and hope is an active one. It takes no courage to be an optimist. Of course, you can always say, "Oh yeah, things will get better." You're not such a courageous person to say things will get better. But it takes a great deal of courage to have hope. To say that I'm going to make things better, that's a great courageous person. Knowing what we do of our past, no Jew can be an optimist. We've had a very dark history. But Jews have never, despite a history of sometimes awesome suffering, given up hope. We have never done such a thing. Look at the last quote. "All significant change in human behavior takes place at the microcosmic, not the macrocosmic level. It belongs to not to social forces or trends, but to the here and now of single individuals." You think about what Rabbi Akiva was able to accomplish, a single individual who was willing to stand up to the challenge, who was willing to keep on pushing in life and bring about the greatest renaissance of Torah by those five students that he was willing to teach after suffering a loss of everything he had worked for in his life. That's something that should give us so much courage, so much strength to think about the fact that we have so much that we can contribute. As much as life might be difficult sometimes, as much as we might fail once in a while, we should always think about this message of Rabbi Akiva, that he never gave up hope, and he was always willing to contribute to the further betterment of the Jewish destiny, of the Jewish story. Amir Hashem, we will continue.